From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Lyme disease, West Nile virus, Zika, and the plague, all of them nasty diseases spread by ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. And just as much of the country flirts with summer these days and the warm weather that allows those insects to flourish, a new report from the CDC finds that since 2004, these infections have tripled all across the country. Folks are vulnerable and getting sick, sometimes very gravely and sometimes for life. This hour on Point, the surge in insect-borne diseases. You can join us on air or online. Does the CDC report confirm what you're seeing in your community? Do you suffer from one of these diseases? What questions do you have about tick, mosquito, and flea-borne diseases? Join us at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me now from Fort Collins, Colorado, is Dr. Lyle Peterson. He's one of the authors of the CDC report. He's the director of the Division of Vector-Borne Diseases at the CDC, where he works to protect the American public from emerging and endemic bacterial and viral pathogens spread by ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. And Lyle Peterson, Dr. Peterson, good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
So the top line of this report from the CDC seems to be that illnesses from mosquito, tick, and flea bites more than tripled from 2004 to 2016. Tell us what stands out to you.
Well, the data show that we're seeing a steady increase in spread of tick-borne diseases and an accelerating trend of mosquito-borne diseases introduced from other parts of the world. We examined over 640,000 cases of diseases from mosquitoes, ticks, and flea bites that were reported in the United States and its territories from 2004 to 2016. And as what you mentioned is we found that the number of reported cases of these diseases tripled from 2004 to 2016. But we also know that this number of cases greatly underestimates what's truly out there. For example, we have 36,000 cases of Lyme disease reported every year, but we estimate that more than 300,000 cases occur every year. So these data indicate that the diseases from mosquito ticks and flea bites are increasing. And we also found that 9 new vector-borne diseases, or diseases caused by these insects, were introduced or discovered in the U.S. since 2004. So the burden appears to be getting worse, and I think importantly it will take all of us working together to prevent and control this onslaught of diseases from mosquitoes, ticks, and fleas.
Well, I want to talk to you, Dr. Peterson, about what can be done and what that means, all working together. But I want to just dig in a little bit more into the data. What does the report say about where, what parts of the U.S. are most afflicted by this, by these increases?
Well, all parts of the United States and its territories are affected. So it's a problem that affects all of us. Different parts of the country have different problems. For example, up in the Northeast and the upper Midwest, there's a giant Lyme disease problem, which is expanding. In the western parts of the United States, we see a lot more West Nile virus.
Right. Now, we're talking, as you mentioned, diseases spread by ticks, mosquitoes, fleas, including Lyme disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, West Nile, and Zika. Which of these, I'm curious, which of these insects, first of all, represents the biggest risk?
Well, both the mosquitoes and ticks are the biggest problems. The flea-borne diseases are plague. They're fortunately more rare because they're so severe. But really, the problems with mosquitoes and ticks are greatly increasing. What we're seeing with the ticks is that these ticks are expanding in geographic distribution, affecting more and more people, putting more and more people at risk. And with the mosquito-borne diseases, we're seeing this increasing trend towards imported exotic mosquito-borne diseases that are affecting large parts of the country and its territories, as well as travelers to other parts of the world.
Yeah. So what explains this increase that we're seeing in more of these infections and the prevalence of these kinds of diseases and more of these insects? What explains this?
Well, I think there's three main causes. One is that globalization. All of these diseases around the world are now simply a plane flight away. They can be transported from the remotest regions of Africa, let's say, or Asia, to the United States in less than 24 hours. And that's what we saw with West Nile virus in 1999 and with chikungunya virus in 2014 and then Zika virus in 2015. So this trend appears to be accelerating. The other thing is that we're changing our environment in many, many ways that seem to promote these diseases from establishing themselves and spreading. A good example of it is Lyme disease, which is spreading rapidly in the United States. And that's really a problem of reforestation. You know, forests have grown back. The number of deer have greatly increased. That has increased the number of deer ticks. And at the same time, people are now living in, you know, these reforested areas out in the suburbs where deer are everywhere, and they're being exposed to these ticks and getting Lyme disease. The other problem is that we're really not fully prepared to deal with these problems. We really don't have great methods of controlling the ticks or even some of these mosquito-borne diseases. So we need to do a lot more work in trying to figure out how to best control these.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the question of climate change and all this. I mean, if longer and hotter spring and summer doesn't that mean longer seasons for these animals to breed and live? In other words, I want you to comment to the extent that you can on how climate change contributes to this problem.
Well, warmer temperatures affect many of these diseases in many ways, making them worse. So, for example, when you have warmer temperatures, that seems to promote West Nile virus outbreaks. So all the major outbreaks of West Nile virus in the U.S. have occurred during heat waves. So the more heat waves you have, the more outbreaks you get from that, as well as other mosquito-borne diseases. You know, for the tick-borne diseases, what happens is when there's warmer temperatures, it does two things. One is it allows the ticks to live further north, thus causing them to spread into new areas. And it also increases the length of tick season so that more people are exposed over longer periods of time.
Mm. I want to talk a little bit about the severity of some of these illnesses, Dr. Peterson. Last summer in Plainfield, Indiana, 2-year-old Kenley Ratliff died of Rocky Mountain spotted fever. This is a rare tick-borne illness, as I understand it, that's on the rise in the Midwest. This is Kenley's aunt, Jordan Clapp, talking to reporters about how Kenley's symptoms escalated from a high fever to death in just a matter of days.
We don't want any family to go through what we did. It just happened so fast, and we couldn't do anything about it. She was just laying there in the hospital bed, living off of a breathing tube, and we couldn't do a thing for her.
It's terrible to hear that, Dr. Peterson. I'm wondering, I understand that you yourself got sick from West Nile virus a few years back. I mean, these are serious, serious illnesses. Do you want to talk a little bit about your own experience?
Yeah, and I think my experience shows that it's really important that people think of these ticks and mosquitoes as more than summertime nuisances. They're diseases that really can really cause severe disease, or as was just pointed out, can even kill you. My experience was that I simply went outside to go get my mail, and I thought I'd only be out there for a minute, and so I didn't put on mosquito repellent. I thought, well, what's my risk in, you know, 2 minutes? But I ran into a friend at my mailbox, and we'd sat outside talking, and we noticed we both were getting bitten by mosquitoes, so we actually went indoors. And then 3 days later, both of us got West Nile virus. And I can tell you, I was sick for 3 months, and it was the worst illness I've had in my life.
I'm so sorry. So let's talk a little bit about what's being done to counter this increase. Who's responsible principally for the lines of defense? I mean, what's your thinking about this in terms of how to prevent this?
Well, I think everyone is responsible for helping deal with these problems. Certainly at the federal government level and CDC, we're trying to do more research to try and figure out better ways of controlling these ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. We're also helping to state health departments and local health departments build their capacities to do surveillance and to help protect the public. Universities can help also do research to help figure out better ways to diagnose and control these diseases, and everyone can do take measures to help protect themselves from getting bitten by ticks and mosquitoes and fleas.
Right.
So it's really something that everyone needs to be part of.
And I guess sort of for the average person out there listening to this and hoping that he or she can enjoy some time in the summer sun, I mean, how do you walk the line between I assume you don't want to make people panic here, but what's sort of the bottom line advice about how to stay safe in the summer?
Well, first, we want people to go outside and enjoy themselves. And we don't want people not exercising, not going outside. We want people to enjoy their life. The major thing is that people can just take some simple measures to protect themselves. They just need to do it. You know, things like wearing insect repellent will greatly help. Putting permethrin on your clothing and your backpack or your tent or whatever can help keep insects away as well. Wearing long sleeve shirts and long pants can also help keep the ticks off, and same with the mosquitoes. And controlling ticks and fleas on your pets can also help. And importantly, in areas where there's Lyme disease, checking for ticks, because it takes a couple of days or a day or two for the bacteria that causes Lyme disease to get in your body. So removing the ticks promptly after being outdoors can greatly reduce your risk.
All right. Well, Dr. Lyle Peterson, director of the Division of Vector-Borne Diseases at the Center for Disease Control, where he works to protect the American public from emerging and endemic bacterial and viral pathogens spread by ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. Dr. Lyle Peterson, thank you so much for joining us. We're very grateful.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Listeners, we're discussing the big increase in diseases caused by ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. You can join the conversation. Have you gotten sick from a bite from one of these insects? What happened? We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Hey, I'm Kelly McEvers, host of NPR's Embedded, and we've got a new episode all about how Scott Pruitt ended up running the EPA. It's a story about Pruitt's life in the Southern Baptist Church, how he handled a major pollution case, and why he sued the EPA 14 times. Just search for Embedded on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the increase in diseases such as Lyme and Zika and West Nile. You can join the conversation. What are you doing to protect yourself? Have you stopped taking your dog on hikes in the woods? Do you cover yourself in off to go outside and barbecue? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I want to introduce a couple of guests who we're going to spend the rest of the hour with talking about this issue and taking your questions. Felicia Kiesing is a community ecologist who studies tick-borne diseases, and she's a professor at Bard College. Felicia Kiesing, good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony.
And Dr. John Aucott, director of the Johns Hopkins Lyme Disease Clinical Research Center. He's an assistant professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, where he is an internist and Lyme disease expert. John Aucott, welcome to you. It's good to have you.
Yeah. Hi, Anthony.
Felicia, let me start with you, if I can. What's your response to this report that we were discussing there in the first segment? Were you surprised by this report from the CDC?
I wasn't surprised. I spent a lot of time thinking about tick-borne diseases and looking at the numbers, so it's been apparent that the numbers are increasing. It's really interesting to see it all in one place and to look at the huge number of people who are being affected by these diseases across the country.
Right. And what about you, John Aucott? What are you seeing in your clinic, for example?
Every year we see more cases of Lyme disease. Actually, we saw our first case yesterday for the late spring season starting. So it started in Maryland, and that's pretty predictable. Every year, May and June, the cases start to come in.
Mm. So you've seen your first case, and this is when cases start to come in. But evidence of this increase that we were talking to Dr. Peterson of the CDC before in the first segment, are you seeing that evidence of increases that he was describing?
Yeah, we see increases both around the Mid-Atlantic area, but also patients that are referred to our center from areas like Virginia, which has only recently become endemic for large numbers of cases. So we see the increase geographically also from western Pennsylvania as it spread from eastern Pennsylvania across to the western border. So we see those increases geographically as well.
All right. Let's go to our callers. We've got a lot of them who want to get in on this conversation. So we'll start with Paul, who's calling from New Bedford, New Hampshire. Paul, it's good to have you on the air. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Bedford, New Hampshire, but no worries.
Excuse me for that. I know Bedford. I should have known better. Sorry about that.
Right. Well, I started feeling lousy, some sort of gamminess in my legs and a fatness in my tongue and just general neurological symptoms in December. I went to a neurologist in January. He did a bunch of tests, including the CDC sanctioned Lyme scan. He said, no, you definitely don't have Lyme. Meanwhile, I had people buzzing in my ear that had had close personal experiences with Lyme, where their friends or relatives had gone months or years being misdiagnosed. I went to a specialist who happens to be a naturopath, paid a ton of money out of pocket for sophisticated testing, and came back with a clear diagnosis of Lyme. So my question is, does my experience ring true with your guests? And where's the breakdown in testing? Because, boy, this has been an expensive and, very difficult disease to deal with.
Paul, I'm really sorry that you've had to deal with this. I'll start with you, John Aucott, in response to Paul's question.
Sure. Hi, Paul. So it does ring true. We see lots of patients that are referred for longstanding or chronic symptoms that may be due to tick-borne illness. So it does ring true. It's the most difficult area, I would say, because we still don't have a clear understanding of why those cases are occurring. And the testing for these kind of longstanding symptoms and illness disease are not as good as they are for some of the other stages, especially the neurologic symptoms. We see those a lot. So I'm very sympathetic, and that's why there's such a need for research into these more chronic symptoms. It is an area that needs a lot of attention.
Mm. Felicia Kiesing, in terms of new research, what is needed? In other words, from where you sit, what don't we know, and what do we need to have a better understanding of here to get a handle on this?
Well, my focus is primarily on prevention. So I'm trying to prevent situations like the one that Paul finds himself in by preventing cases of occurring in the first place. And one of the big questions is what people like Paul and others living in tick-infested areas can do to protect themselves. We don't, at the moment, have a method that people can use in their yards or in their communities that's been demonstrated to reduce the number of cases in that area. That's a project that I'm working on right now with some collaborators, and we're testing whether we can do something in people's yards that actually keeps them from getting sick. So I think that's a big open area. We don't have an answer to that question yet, and we need one.
Hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about that project? What are you working on specifically?
Yeah, well, we call it the Tick Project, and we're testing two different environmentally safe methods of tick control that have been shown to reduce ticks before in other studies. We're testing them on a very large scale where we have entire neighborhoods here where I live in Dutchess County, New York, enrolled in the study, and each neighborhood gets one of four different combinations of treatments, and we've followed the neighborhoods over 5 years to actually monitor the cases of tick-borne disease that occur in that neighborhood. And so we'll be able to say whether one or the other of those two treatments that we're testing actually reduces cases.
And Felicia, in the first segment, we were listening to Dr. Lyle Peterson of the CDC talking about what people need to do. And it's sort of the same message that we've been hearing for a long time. Just protect yourself. Use permethrin. Wear long pants and long sleeve shirts when you go outside. I mean, is that where we are still, or is there more that we can do and should know about?
I think that's where we are. I mean, there are some other things you can do in addition to wearing long-sleeved shirts and long pants and having your pant legs tucked into your socks, for example. One of them is that studies have shown that actually bathing after you come in, taking off all your clothes and bathing after you come in seems to help. And then also putting your clothes in the dryer, putting dry clothes in the dryer for 10 or 15 minutes on high heat will actually kill ticks so that you haven't then brought the ticks into your home with your clothes. So, but we're still at this level of personal protection, assuming that your exposure outside in the world is fairly constant, and we're trying to keep those ticks from getting onto you and making you sick. And what I would like to do is find ways to, in an environmentally safe way, actually prevent the ticks from getting onto people in the first place.
That's interesting. So say more about that. How would that work in an environmentally safe way to keep ticks from getting on you in the first place?
Well, the two methods that we're testing are first a fungus that's naturally occurring. It occurs around many parts of the world. It's in the soil, and it kills arthropods. There's a particular strain that's been developed commercially that you can have applied to your yard, and it reduces the abundance of ticks in people's yards. So that's one method. It targets ticks quite specifically, so it's safe again for other arthropods. And then the other method is another commercial product. It's called the Tick Control System. It's basically a small box that has a little trap door and a little bit of bait inside, and it attracts small rodents that come in attracted to the bait. And while they're in there, they get dabbed with a little bit of a chemical called fipronil. It's an acaricide. It kills ticks. And that it's the same product that's used in Frontline, which a lot of your listeners probably use on their pets. And that product keeps the tick, kills the ticks on the rodent host for several weeks. And we know that the rodents are actually the most critical player in this whole system for infecting the ticks with the tick-borne pathogens.
Interesting. So putting the rodents to work in the...
Exactly.
Very interesting. Let's go to Sonia, who's calling from Wallingford, Connecticut. Sonia, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Anthony. My question is very much like the first caller's. I have been tested for Lyme disease. I was diagnosed 30 years ago with Lyme disease, and have heard all this and read this that it, you know, never really goes away. And I've had a lot of inflammatory issues over the years and lots of tests for Lyme disease. And some the screenings come back positive. The Western blot comes back negative, not enough bands. Just this past week, I just got another test done because I have incredible pain in my neck and down my back. And it came back positive on the Western blot, so 5 bands. And yet I just came back from the doctor half an hour ago, and they say, no, we're not saying that you don't, it's not, because a screening came back negative. So a screening test came back negative, that the doctor had ordered a Western blot, came back 5 bands. It's so confusing. So I left there bewildered. They're like, no, it's not coming from that, you know, some neurological problem that you have.
Well, Sonia, I'm really sorry. I send you so much sympathy for having to deal with this for so long. Dr. Aucott, what do you hear in Sonia's story?
So Sonia presents one of the biggest gaps in our knowledge. The current test she's talking about, the Western blot, is an antibody test. So antibody tests don't directly detect the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. They only detect your own immune system's response to the bacteria. So those have big limitations because they don't actually tell you if the bacteria is still there. So we really need on the research end what are called direct tests that actually detect the nucleic acid or the proteins or some direct molecule of the bacteria so we could answer Sonia's question about whether there's still infection or not. An antibody test can't do that. That only tells you that your immune system has recognized it and remembers it like it remembers many or all of the bacteria and viruses that we encounter throughout our life.
Well, Sonia, we really wish you the best. And John Aucott, I want to ask you one more question off of Sonia's call. I mean, she mentioned a point that we hear a lot, that when you get Lyme disease, it never really goes away. With the current state of medical treatment on this issue, is that still the case, really the case?
So we think that in the majority of people, the Lyme disease does go away. In other words, the bacteria is treated with the antibiotic and it goes away. But what I think she's hinting at here is this subgroup of people that get treated with standard antibiotics but then have a lingering chronic illness that doesn't go away. And that illness goes by different names. Patients often identify with the term chronic Lyme disease. In the research world where I am, we call it post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome. But it's a real disease and it occurs in approximately 10 to 20% of people after they've been treated for Lyme disease, and yet they don't seem to get rid of all their symptoms. And it can be prolonged and chronic and really quite devastating and impactful in a person's life.
Felicia Kiesing, I'd like to come to you and sort of expand on a point that Dr. Peterson made in the first segment about what is causing this. And he focused on three things: globalization, changes in our environment, specifically more forestation, and the fact that we're not prepared. From where you sit, is that the correct focus? Is the CDC looking correctly at the causes here?
I think they've got the right list. I want to follow up on what Dr. Peterson mentioned about the changing environment, because he pointed out in particular that reforestation is a challenge and an underlying cause. And I would maybe expand on that a little bit to say that the height of reforestation for most of the eastern United States has occurred over the 19th and 20th centuries, not at this period of time when we're seeing these huge increases. What's really happening now is not reforestation, but forest fragmentation. It's the cutting back of those forests into little tiny pieces. And the reason that that's so important is that when a forest is cut into little tiny pieces, the larger animals that eat rodents disappear or tend to disappear, things like foxes, for example. And it's those rodents, as I said before, that are primarily responsible for infecting the ticks. So what we're seeing is this fragmentation that leads to an abundance of the very hosts that are most responsible for infecting the ticks. What he also pointed out is that people are tending to live in those forests, and that's why the forests are becoming fragmented in the first place. So you get these forests cut up into little tiny pieces, people move into those little pieces, and that's exactly where there are lots of hosts, these small rodents that are infecting the ticks. So it's a sort of perfect recipe, but it's not the reforestation per se, it's what's happened since the reforestation, it's this fragmentation.
That's really interesting. I mean, that's an important distinction. Yeah, so essentially by chopping up the forests, we've sort of done a disservice to the overall environment that would have had a better chance of balancing itself out. A kind of food chain, I guess you could say, has been disrupted.
Yeah, what we see is that the higher the biodiversity of hosts in forests, the less Lyme disease risk, the lower the number of infected ticks. And that biodiversity is correlated with having big patches of forest. The other part of the story I would mention that I've now emphasized a couple of times is that deer are often given a lot of credit, but actually these rodents play a bigger role, really, in the part that humans care about, which is the number of these ticks that are infected. So even though we might not welcome deer as neighbors, rodents are even worse.
That's interesting. Huh. So deers aren't necessarily say more about that, because the deer aren't carrying as many infected ticks as the rodents?
So there are two things to keep in mind about what determines risk for a tick-borne disease. One is how many ticks there are, and the other is how many ticks are infected. So the deer do play a role in feeding ticks and leading to a number of ticks, although they're far from the only host that affects how many ticks there are. There are lots of other hosts that affect how many ticks there are. And the deer play no role at all in infecting ticks. In fact, the deer don't infect ticks, so it's much better for a tick to feed on a deer than on a mouse, because the tick that comes off that deer would not be infected, whereas the one that comes off the mouse would be much more likely to be. So if you separate out those two components, it's pretty clear that the rodents are the ones responsible for passing on the infection. Some people think that the deer, if you could get rid of deer entirely, then you would not have a Lyme disease problem because there simply wouldn't be any ticks. But that's not really borne out by the evidence. There are a few islands where people have been able to extirpate deer completely. If you have no deer, then you can reduce tick populations under some conditions, but that basically requires an island. To keep tick populations in most of the United States, all you need is just a few deer or other hosts that ticks are happy to feed on. So it's not really, the deer kind of get a bum rap on this.
Really interesting. Listeners, we're talking about a new report from the CDC showing a big increase in recent years in vector-borne diseases. Those are diseases that are carried by ticks, mosquitoes, and fleas. And we seem to be spending a lot of time this hour talking about Lyme disease specifically, and deer ticks and disease carried by rodents. How concerned are you? Have you changed the way you live outside to protect yourself? I'm Anthony Brooks. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
I'm I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics Podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about a new CDC report that found diseases caused by ticks, mosquitoes, and other insects have more than tripled since 2004. You can join the conversation. Do you think that the government, your local community government, is doing enough to protect you? What more should they do? I'm talking to Felicia Kiesing, an ecologist who studies tick-borne diseases. She's a professor at Bard College, and Dr. John Aucott, who is the director of the Johns Hopkins Lyme Disease Clinical Research Center. He's an assistant professor at the School of Medicine and an internist. And we're taking your calls, 1-800-423-8255, and let's jump right back into them. David is calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina. David, good to have you. What's on your mind?
Oh, hello, Anthony. My daughter, she is 17. She'll be 17 on May 10th. And she's been suffering from Lyme disease for the last 3 years. And it's at the point where it's chronic. And I've taken her to Connecticut. I've taken her to Atlanta, you know, to see different doctors. And a lot of doctors have put her on antibiotics. And it seems like the antibiotics have no real effect on helping to cure the disease. She's been diagnosed with Lyme's, the Bartonella rash, and the Babesia. So, you know, we have health insurance, but you take her to the doctor, and, you know, for one thing, they're not educated on Lyme disease to even know how to help treat her.
Got it. David, I'm really sorry for what your daughter is going through. John Aucott, couple of points there, but the last point intrigues me. David was mentioning that a lot of medical professionals may be not up to speed on this disease as much as they could be.
Well, that's right, and I think that's one of the things this recent CDC report emphasizes is there's a lot to keep up on. You know, the report mentioned new pathogens and pathogens that are becoming increasingly important. The one I would point out, for instance, is Babesia, which is a malaria-like pathogen that's carried by the same ticks that carry Lyme disease. And a lot of practitioners aren't aware that this Babesia pathogen occurs now in the Northeast. And it's an important point because it's treated differently than Lyme disease is. The pathogen is not sensitive to doxycycline like Borrelia is that causes Lyme disease. So there's a lot to keep up on, and there's new agents. Borrelia miyamotoi was really just shown to cause human disease a couple of years ago. Many physicians haven't even heard of it yet because it's a changing landscape. And I think that's what this report was so important to bring to everyone's awareness.
Mm. Let's go to Anna, who's calling from New Orleans. Anna, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Anthony and guests. I'm calling because my personal experience is with a blighted lot, and we've had a lot arise in that since 2004 with abandoned properties. And I'm in New Orleans. We live on the water. We have a large mosquito population anyways. The lot next door to me has a semi-open pool. It's grown up. It's went to auction several times. We're in a fight with the city over it. It's been years. We can't get them to do anything. There's rodents, so she mentioned the rodent population. And so I know that this is a problem around the country for a lot of people in cities, and I think that it probably contributes a lot to the problems that we're seeing.
Anna, thanks for the call. Felicia Kiesing, is Anna right? It sounds logical that this would contribute to the problem.
Yeah, there's evidence, particularly from California, showing that abandoned homes, this happened particularly during the financial crisis in the around 10 years ago, that abandoned homes, especially with pools, lead to increased numbers of mosquitoes, and the consequences for disease are what you'd expect them to be. So that's a real problem. And in cities, we know that the two mosquitoes that are responsible for the mosquito-borne diseases that are really stand out in this report, Aedes albopictus and Aedes aegypti, tend to breed in those kinds of environments, you know, in standing water and pools of water that are still. So that could be some kind of container in someone's yard. It could be just garbage in which rainwater collects. So these things really are a problem.
Mm. Let's go to Mary, who's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts, just down the road from our studios. Mary, a similar point as our last caller. Go ahead.
Yes, I live in Cambridge, the heart of the city, West Cambridge, and last summer I found a deer in my backyard. Also, we've had wild geese, and other parts of Cambridge have reported rabbits. And I told Animal Control, I told the city, and they didn't seem very concerned. I mean, this, we're not in reforested areas, we're not in homes with abandoned houses or any of these things. We're in the heart of the city, and I believe we should do something preventive rather than wait till people start getting sick and having their lives ruined.
Mary, thanks so much for that call. Felicia Kiesing, respond to Mary, and I have a question sort of off the back of that call, and that is, are we seeing these increases in the kind of neighborhoods that Mary is just calling about? West Cambridge, it's a nice urban, but it's an urban neighborhood.
Yeah, you know, the species that are really responsible for infecting ticks and for feeding ticks, so that the ticks can continue their life cycle, are survivors. You know, they're ones that can survive really close to human homes. Mary mentioned a couple of different kinds of animals that can do that. So we have two issues. One is, how do we prevent areas that don't currently have a problem from becoming problematic, right, having these concentrations of animals that contribute to the Lyme cycle. But then what do we do for people like Mary? And that's really the question she's asking about. This is an area that is potentially already high risk. It's got all the components to have a Lyme disease problem. So what do we do in those high risk areas? And that's really the focus, again, of this tick project. What do we do if someone is already living in a place that where we need to try to prevent Lyme disease from becoming severe?
Mary, thanks so much for that call. Let's go to Josh, who's calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Josh, good to have you. What's on your mind?
Hi, Anthony. I have a comment first and then a question. Much like the prior callers, I was getting increasingly ill over the past 5 years. Saw, 20 different doctors. Finally was told I had autonomic neuropathy, but it was idiopathic or unknown cause. And so I've spent the past year and a half trying to figure out why. And like some of the other callers, just got some more test results back because I had tested negative for Lyme disease, but I did test positive for the Babesia, like was mentioned by one of the prior callers. And then I did more research, and I found that autonomic dysfunction is a hallmark symptom of that particular illness. And my question is then, what other co-infections can occur that people need to watch out for, and are there hallmark symptoms of each of them that would indicate that you need to seek out a Lyme-literate doctor?
Got it, Josh. Thanks for the call. And again, my sympathy for what you're dealing with. John Aucott, do you want to talk to Josh?
Sure, Josh. I think the hallmark symptoms actually aren't as frequent as we would like them to be. Many of these tick-borne infections present with very similar symptoms, fever, chills, achiness, fatigue. And so the hallmark symptoms actually, of course, we want those because they'll help us. I would say the one hallmark, one of the hallmark signs is the round red rash of Lyme disease. And I think it's important to point out, even after prevention, one thing we see a missed opportunity for is identification of the early Lyme disease rash. It's called erythema migrans. And I think there's a big misconception that it has to look like a ring within a ring bullseye target. And we've noticed through our research that actually the majority of the time it doesn't look like that. And we've also noticed that the majority of the time people misidentify it and miss the opportunity for early diagnosis. They see the round red rash, but it doesn't have the target lesion, so they don't think of Lyme disease. And actually, one of our research projects we're currently doing with the Applied Physics Lab at Johns Hopkins is we're actually doing deep learning with computer-assisted diagnosis, because it looks like actually a computer can read a skin rash lesion more accurately than patients and even some non-sophisticated physicians. So we desperately need to catch Lyme disease at an early stage from its hallmark sign, which is this round red rash. If we do it at the early stage, then the later stages that our callers are calling about are largely prevented. So that's another missed opportunity right now.
Mm. A couple of comments from our website at onpointradio.org. Thinkin15 writes, I was looking forward to going out in my yard and working in my flower bed and patio pots. Now I'm thinking that I have to slather myself with anti-tick poison or dress up like it's cold out. Bummer. And Chicken Little writes, why not give vaccines for Lyme disease? My dog gets one. John Aucott, I want to ask you, how close are we to a Lyme disease vaccine?
So there was a previous Lyme disease vaccine that was removed from the market for humans. The dog vaccine was not. There are several groups now working on human vaccines. They're in the early to mid phase. So progress will be measured, I think, in years. So it's going to be a little while, but they are on the way.
And let's go to Mark, who's calling from Owensboro, Kentucky. Mark, you're on the air. It's good to have you. What's on your mind?
Hello, Anthony. I just wanted to bring up a couple of prevention issues that might work for some people. They won't work for all of them. But one of the things that I've learned from some of my more rural neighbors are that getting rid of ticks can be as easy as keeping chickens and guineas and other types of yard fowl, basically, that just really a lot of ticks. Also, as far as the fragmented forest issue is concerned, a lot of people these days do not burn off their understory of their forest like they used to way back in the day. And that will really reduce the number of ticks, the number of rodents that are carrying them, and can really be an and you know have a great impact on it. Of course, there's safety issues, and not just anybody wants to do it. But
Mark, explain that. What does that mean to burn off the understory of a forest?
It's basically being very careful about your fire and monitoring it and staying right with your fire and just burning off the leaf litter, the small growth grasses and such that are you know you don't want to burn your trees, but you want to burn off all that litter.
Got it.
In the floor of the forest.
Got it. Mark, thanks so much for the call. Felicia Kiesing, two things there. I'm intrigued about Mark's suggestion of chickens.
Yeah, this comes up a lot. There's a local chicken war going on in my little community about whether chickens are a good thing or a bad thing. There is evidence that chickens do eat ticks. In other words, there have been ticks found in chicken crops, so that we know that they do eat them. But there is, to my knowledge, no evidence that actually having chickens in your yard reduces the abundance of ticks. And I have actually myself been a part of a study on the guinea fowl, which have long been rumored to eat so many ticks that they keep numbers of ticks down. And we actually did an experimental study of that, looking at yards that with people who did or did not have guinea fowl in a as clean an experimental design as we could. And we found no evidence that the guinea fowl actually reduced the abundance of ticks in yards, even in the same neighborhood.
Mm.
So there are wonderful reasons to have chickens or guinea fowl, but there is not a good evidence that that actually reduces the abundance of ticks.
So fresh eggs among the wonderful reasons, not
Many
so much
reasons.
Not so much on the elimination of ticks. What about the suggestion of carefully burning off the undergrowth? How does that strike you?
Well, I can imagine environments in which that might be a useful strategy, but the environments in which I work, that would not be a viable strategy. We're talking about the high risk areas for Lyme disease in much of the Northeast are areas that are dense suburban neighborhoods, and so burning off the understory or the leaf litter in those areas is not really a viable management strategy. But again, there might be places where that's a possibility. I also do some work in East Africa, and that's been a long time tick reduction strategy in parts there. But again, on very large properties in very specific conditions.
Let's try to get one more call in before we run out of time. Jennifer is calling from Appalachian in New York. Am I pronouncing that right, Jennifer? Sorry.
Yes. That's correct. Thank you.
Good to have you.
I'm calling. Good. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. My 14-year-old daughter was diagnosed 4 years ago with Lyme. She had a 9-inch bullseye, and it was a very difficult period. We couldn't get doxycycline that we needed. But my main point, you were talking about public policy. Their summer camps are about to start up. It is not taken seriously at the summer camps. And my daughter has attended multiple ones in Connecticut and Massachusetts. She's gone, and she knows what to do to care for herself. you know, she has long hair. She is difficult to check for ticks, but it's not something that is really a part of the culture at these summer camps. And the kids are outside constantly.
Jennifer, it's a great point. John Aucott, is that true? I mean, is this would clearly relate to the challenge that we've been discussing this entire hour.
Absolutely, Anthony. I think, you know, education, and it's just can't be repeated enough because Jennifer's absolutely right. You know, people have other priorities and they get distracted and they don't hear the message. So I think that's one thing we found over and over again is the power and importance of repeated education. Because again, the callers that are calling with the devastating impact of, you know, later stages and chronic illness, you know, the way to really get ahead of that is to prevent it in the first place or to recognize it early. So I agree with Jennifer. It's all about education and getting the word out. You know, May is Lyme Awareness Month, and I think it's a perfect timing of this report from the CDC along with Lyme Awareness Month and getting the word out for sure.
We're coming up on the end of the hour, but I want to ask you both really quickly to respond to this question because I'd like to end this hour on a hopeful note. Felicia Kiesing, I mean, is there reason at all in the midst of this rather alarming report from the CDC to think hopefully, to be hopeful?
Well, I think that recognition of the problem is the first start, is the first step. And so people are paying attention to this. And the federal government has put some more resources into fighting vector-borne diseases like these recently. So that's hopeful. I certainly am hearing a lot from politicians in the local area and at the state level who are interested in figuring out what role they can play. So I think we're getting to the point where there's enough awareness and concern coming from the public that the people who are in have other policy-related and funding-related options are paying attention. And then I just want to echo what John said. Education throughout the different kinds of places where people can get exposed is really important.
All right. Well, listen, listeners, you can go to our website, onpointradio.org, for information from the CDC about how to protect yourself. Felicia Kiesing, community ecologist who studies tick-borne disease. She's a professor at Bard College. Felicia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Anthony.
And John Aucott, director of the Johns Hopkins Lyme Disease Clinical Research. John Aucott, great to have you as well.
Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you. Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.